the Fermi momentum.
So these atoms are completely pressure ionized, so they have no electrons around them. So the number of electrons is just equal to the density times the charge of the ions. Sometimes we'll do an average ion sort of thing, where we'll have all the ions be the same with just an average number, but we also do multi-component systems as well. And the important parameter in these systems is this Coulomb parameter, gamma. It just relates the potential energy to the kinetic energy. And A is the inner ion spacing. So notice that you can, if you know a gamma, you can relate the temperature and the density of the system. And we use the velocity relay algorithm, which hopefully some of you are familiar with. It just splits up the velocity terms into two half steps, where the first half step, you compute it using the previous version of the acceleration, and then for the final half step, you use the updated version for the acceleration. And this gives us a global error of order, just the time step squared. So this is delta t squared, not delta t squared, if that makes sense. Okay, so this is what a picture of one of our simulations looks like. I have to admit, it's not as exciting as the supernova simulations or the binary merger simulations. They're just a whole bunch of ions that we watch move around. And we use a program called VMD, which was developed by people at Urbana. So with just this one approach, we can compute a whole lot of different microphysics. Chuck's list was longer than mine is, but mine is a subset of his list that he gave yesterday. So I'll be talking about thermoconductivity and shear modulus briefly. But we have recent diffusion in liquid and solid papers, and we're working on a couple phase diagram papers as well. So the thermoconductivity is just dominated by the heat that's carried away by the electrons. Since the ions can't move very far, they can't carry heat away quickly. And the important part is the inelastic collisions to transfer momentum, because if you have elastic collisions, it doesn't really do a whole lot. So it turns out that the only thing that we actually need to compute is the structure factor for all of these systems, and then we can relate that to the thermoconductivity. And the structure factor that we compute, we can either compute it directly or we can look at the G of R, the pairwise correlation function. And it has this crystal term, the Bragg term, and then it has these inelastic excitations. And the Bragg term is really simple to remove just because it's a series of delta functions. So after we do that, we give a value for the thermoconductivity. And it's also been computed in an amorphous solid. And so we notice that the thermoconductivity is low in an amorphous solid and high in a crystalline solid. And this is the same plot that Chuck showed yesterday, showing that the data currently match a crystalline solid. So this is a star that, this is KS1731, that accreted for around 10 years, I think, maybe 18, and then stopped accreting, and then we watched it cool. So it accreted up until this point, and time zero is when the outburst stopped. And we noticed that we being the observers, noticed that the temperature dropped rather quickly. So if it were an amorphous solid, then it would be this curve up here, and that obviously doesn't match the data. So this is an interesting result just from one part of our molecular dynamics code. Another thing that we can do that seems to be of interest to people here is compute the shear modulus more or less directly. So what we do is we take the system and then deform it and watch to see how the system responds. So there's a paper by Ogata et al. In 1990 that did it in a Monte Carlo sort of fashion. But the general idea is right, you shear it and compute these elastic constants. And the shear modulus turns out to be rather sensitive to the long tails of the distribution. Because remember, it's the potential never completely goes to zero. It's a decaying exponential. So these calculations really couldn't be done before the last, five or so years, just because you need an awful lot of ions in your system in order to get good results. So hopefully this is visible. Not a whole lot. So this plot over here compares our results to the Ogata et al. Paper. I don't know if you can see these green dots up here. So using this, the slightly different potential, he just used a straight Coulomb potential. We have a slight reduction in the shear modulus. And as far as I understand, most people who use a shear modulus use a result that's sort of based on the Sogata et al. Result. So we do get a slightly lower shear modulus. And if you ignore the superfluid neutrons, so like I said, I'm mainly concerned with the outer crust, the shear speed is just proportional to the square root of the shear modulus. So a 10% change in the shear modulus leads to about a 5% change in shear speed. And that should be observable. And I talked before about these finite size effects that we need large systems. You'll notice that these red dots up here are for a rather small system. And then the bottom solid line is from our larger system. So I could spend a whole lot more time going into things that we actually compute with the shear with the molecular dynamics code, but instead I'll talk about our code itself. So, like I said, we need large computers in order to do these sorts of calculations because we have many, many ions. And here are some things that our code needs. So for each ion, the force must be computed directly from every other ion's influence on it. This is an inherently n-squared process. We can use a cutoff radius. So we've determined that after about 10 screening lengths, there's not a whole lot of influence on any of the parameters that we compute. So we can cut it off there. And that makes it scale a little better than n squared, because you only care about guys that are in this sphere around you. So every time step, we just compute, or we update the positions, velocity, and carry, mass, and charge. So it's a few bytes per ion. And we've done systems with our code up to around 100,000 ions. So, I mean, if you multiply 100,000 and these numbers together, you can see that this will fit on memory of pretty much any node that you would ever use. So OpenMP and MPI end up working very well for us because we just copy the data from node to node. So we use this hybrid scheme in that MPI controls a node, and that OpenMP will then control all the processors on that node. So we do a lot of our runs on Kraken, but we also have a local machine at IU called Big Red, and they have different core counts, so that's why they're listed here. So the OpenMP, I guess, does the important calculations, and the MPI sort of takes care of the overhead. And like I said, using this hybrid scheme is really nice because on Kraken, for example, we'll have 12 MPI process or 12 OpenMP threads per node. That saves us a factor of 12 in communication. So we're allowed to get rather good scalability, and this is with strong scaling. So we haven't started doing computations to see how our weak scaling is. So we can run them moderately. I don't know. It's not 200,000 like some of the codes here, but with larger systems, we can run on the order of 2,000 to 3,000 cores and still not waste a lot of our time. So the rest of this will pretty much be all GPU stuff. So you might ask, you know, our code works on CPUs, so why would we care? It turns out that a CPU is not the best for doing just straight calculations. So here's just a mock-up, or it's actually a CPU with an overlay on it. You probably can't read any of these things, but this bit up here is the floating point unit. So this is the part that does the actual calculations. The rest of the circuitry down here is just using fancy algorithms in order to make a single thread run faster, and then it has, you know, a large cache on chip. So the idea with CPUs is you're only doing one thing at a time, but you're trying to do it very, very quickly. So you try to do these fancy optimizations and do the best that you can. We've started getting into multi-core processors that try to do many things concurrently, but still each core generally looks more or less the same as this. There's a very small part that's actually used for calculations, and a lot of it is just used for algorithm prediction and other fancy things like that. So GPUs are nice in that they're dumber, I guess. They don't try to figure out what you're going to do next, and they don't try to streamline things. All they do is they just throw a whole bunch of cores at you, well, analogous to cores. They're called multiprocessors in the GPU regime. And they also really decrease the chip memory, but they try to pack on as many as they can in as small of a space as possible. So, that, like I said, that decreases the on-chip memory, but then these GPUs also, I'm sure everyone's seen one, comes on a card that also has a shared global memory space that is much larger. So instead of the CPU method where you try to predict what people are going to do or what users are going to do and do it very, very well, the GPU idea is if you have enough calculations going on in the background, you can do your memory transfers and you can do all that sort of stuff and sort of hide it behind the calculations that you're doing. And in order to fully utilize a GPU, you have to have thousands of things going on at the same time, which for I'm sure for anyone's code here is not an issue. So I was going to say stole this slide from NVIDIA, but it was given to me and I'm using it. So this is the blue bits here are like the functional bits of the CPU, the parts that actually do the computation. And then the green bits over here are the parts of the GPU that actually do the computation. So you can just tell by eye that there's a lot more going on in a GPU as far as computation than the CPU. I tried to get the same sort of image of a GPU with the overlay, but those apparently don't exist. So NVIDIA is a graphics company that makes these GPUs, and they wrote these CUDA for C libraries that allow you to directly access the GPUs. When this whole thing first started being developed, people would have to write their own special ways of doing their code that would sort of translate their science problem into a texture and pixel problem. So they'll sort of trick the GPU into thinking it's doing graphics, but it's actually doing, you know, some sort of simulation. NVIDIA figured out that people were starting to do this sort of stuff, and they saw a little piece in the market that they could open up. So they helped us out by writing this CUDA library for C. Most legacy code is not in C. Most of it is in Fortran. At the moment, NVIDIA doesn't have a Fortran compiler. The only one that's available is from PGI, which is a problem for, I guess, small users, but I assume that most people here can get access to PGI compilers. They're not free, but it's a very standard compiler group. So that's not too much of a problem. One thing that was a problem was CUDA doesn't work with devices from other vendors, which makes sense from their standpoint, but perhaps isn't the best thing for us. But there have been efforts to make all GPUs on equal footing. So this is the basic idea behind a CUDA code, is you have, I mean, all GPUs are plugged in through a PCI bus. So you plug it into your motherboard. And the data has to be copied from the CPU to the GPU. So that's this first step. And since you're going over the PCI bus, the data copy can be quite slow. So you're going to want to not do that as much as possible. And then the CPU sort of initiates a function call on the GPU. And then the GPU takes care of everything else. So I said here that the kernel is called with the dimensionality of the task. You can split up your job in different ways, and you just tell it in sort of a loose method how to split it up, and then the GPU takes care of everything. So you don't have to do very low-level optimization. They're trying to make it as easy as possible for people to start using these things and using them quickly. And then once the GPU does its business, it runs to completion and then copies data back from the GPU to the CPU. And then you do another step, essentially. So there are some downsides to using GPUs. There's different types of memory on a GPU. There's the very local memory that is close to all of these threaded processors, and then there's the global DRAM. So if you're using local memory, you can fetch your data in about a clock cycle. Obviously, that's good. If you're using the global DRAM, it takes around 100 clock cycles. So the idea is to put as much of the data that you want to use often as close to the processors as possible and try to eliminate these long data fetches. The downside is that this memory that's close to the processors is very, very small. It's on the order of, you know, 30-something kilobytes is more or less an average now. So if you have a simulation that needs to know where, like, a lot of other particles are, it sort of becomes a problem. Like, our data set will not fit in this space. But depending on what you're doing, that might be all right with you. And then it says up here that it's a shared memory space. So there are synchronization tasks to have all of the threads work on the same set of data and modify it, but then not. If you didn't have synchronization routines, then you could have one thread write it and another one read it and not realize what's going on, and that could lead to problems. So you might be wondering if this is useful for you, for your codes. As is always the case, porting a legacy code is always a task. It's not something that you can just do overnight. So this is a slightly different approach to thinking about how to deal with data. You have to think of it in these very small chunks that you can use very efficiently. So since it's a different approach, it means a different way of thinking. The most important part probably is that the fact there's no communication between thread blocks. So when you launch a task, you'll launch it in these thread blocks of 16 or 32 threads that will work on a small chunk and then return to the GPU. But there's no communication between them. So if your problem is one where you care what other like MPI processes are doing at the same time, assuming you're using an MPI sort of scheme, this could be a killer for you. One thing that you could do is sort of break it up into like a little GPU bit and then a little CPU bit and a little GPU bit and go back and forth and just use the GPU to do the hard independent calculations. So this says, should your code run on GPUs, not can it? I guess you can make any code run on GPUs, but I assume that most of you want to not, or want to fully utilize whatever system you're on. You don't want to just waste your time. So if you have any routines that are, quote unquote, embarrassingly parallel, these fit very well on GPUs. You just sort of give it to the GPU, you tell it what to do, and then it'll return something, hopefully quickly. Like I said before, algorithms that need a lot of communication either need to be modified or you need to not do them. And as I said before, you can split up some of these algorithms to work on the GPU or the CPU. And in general, it seems to be that if you have I/O-bound problems, which I'm not sure is true for anyone in this room, perhaps GPUs aren't best suit for you. So I guess in conclusion, all the different processors on a GPU allow you to really parallelize your code and run it quite quickly. The large codes will need to not just use a single card. I've been to a few talks from people from NVIDIA, and they talk about taking it's usually for chemistry groups, your large code, and then putting it on a box that has four GPUs in it. That probably won't work for anyone in this room because we need much, much larger simulations. So pretty much what you need to do is use the MPI that you have been using and replace what I'm assuming is OpenMP with these GPU routines, just slightly modified. So there are lots of these hybrid CPU-GPU systems coming online, and just a few weeks ago, this top 500 supercomputer list was updated. And three of the top five machines are these hybrid machines. So this is more or less the future of computing, I suppose. And then I'll summarize real quick what I was talking about before with Muckler Dynamics. We use these MD simulations to study a whole bunch of different microphysics in a system. So in order to get larger system sizes, because we could always benefit from having larger system sizes, we need to have very large parallel codes. For the moment, our hybrid scheme is working out well. But in the future, when we need to go to hundreds of thousands or millions of particles, we'll either need to start spending more SUs, like on the TeraGrid, for example, or we can start the transition into a GPU system. If you see talks from NVIDIA, they'll talk about the cost of GPUs is much, much lower than it is for CPUs. And that's generally true. But most people here work on supercomputers, not local machines. So this cheaper solution isn't horribly important. Probably the most important part is that you do have to spend a lot of time porting your code over. So, I mean, pretty much think about what you're doing before that. And then, for those of you who are curious about what what's the very current thing in molecular dynamics. We're going to add magnetic fields to our code. So I'm a fourth year graduate student, and this is the first time that I've seen magnetic fields in our MD codes, and I'm very, very excited because, you know, pretty much if you don't know what's going on, you just sort of attribute it to magnetic fields. So we're going to try to figure out if that's actually true. One reason that it hasn't been implemented up until very recently is because it was unclear how to implement it into the potential calculations in a way that made sense and still allowed us to compute things quickly. Instead, there's a method that we found from a computational physics paper where you incorporate the magnetic fields into the equations of motion. So when you're doing your force calculation, pretty much it's just a straightforward Yukawa calculation. And then the only time the B field comes into play is when you're just stepping through. So we have a code now that does have magnetic fields. We're currently testing it. But the first thing I plan on doing is, well, diffusion because it's an easy calculation, but the first real thing that I plan on doing is the shear modulus to see how this affects things. Another thing that we'll be doing, I don't know if we're going to include magnetic fields with this part, is the shear modulus and breaking strain of these phosphophases to see if that can have a large impact on things. And then personally, I'm going to Spain next year to work with Jose Pons about, you know, using this magnetic field code and hopefully integrate it more into the models that he's been running of the thermal and magnetic evolution of neutron stars. So that's it.
Questions or comments at the talk? I noticed that it's a bit later than planned, but since this is a workshop and not a conference, it's better to go over time than to cut off speakers and cut off the discussion. So comments or questions on that? Harald, let me run up to you.
Oh, right. So I mentioned briefly that CUDA doesn't work on ATI cards or AMD cards, whatever they're calling themselves now. There's recently been a push called OpenCL that is sort of this unified scheme that will work on any machine. I haven't looked into programming in OpenCL, but that does seem to be the next step in these sorts of things.
So the other major advantage of OpenCL is that by just changing a little define, you can run it on your CPU. So if you're on an airplane, you don't have your fancy NVIDIA card in your laptop, you can still debug and work on the code, which I find incredibly useful. And I'm not going to touch CUDA.
Well, there's the most recent toolkit from CUDA also does include that capability as well, where you can turn on or off the GPU bits. So you write the same code and then either compile it for a hybrid machine or compile it for a GPU or compile it just for a CPU.
Further comments? Okay. Excuse me.
Sorry, I've made it difficult. This is probably a question that maybe no one in the room has an answer for, but the thing that's always bothered me about GPUs is it seems like this could be sort of a special point in time, meaning that, you know, obviously all the codes that everyone writes, especially in this room more than me, I think, take years and years to develop, and I worry that getting too specialized into some architecture like this could end up not paying off in the long run.
Right.
Has anyone thought about that? I mean, it sounds like this OpenCL thing being able to be used on standard CPUs and stuff, maybe that's good news, I don't know, but just curious. Like, what's stopping, for example, Intel from deciding, well, I'm just going to start producing chips that have, you know, 24 normal cores and, you know, 1,000 instructions
per
core.
Intel is doing that. Like, okay. They're trying to increase their core count.
But actually adding like some sort of new reduced instruction set cores that supplement the standard
right.
cores that need some new compiler, blah, 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 blah.
Right. There's a hand in the back, but I suppose I can answer while the mic gets up there. This OpenCL thing is sort of that idea, where there have been very specialized architectures that pretty much no one ever wanted to spend their time on, because if it's something that you spend a lot of time building and then only run for a few years because that technology goes away, it's not as useful. Like, the same sort of thing happened with MD Grape boards. You have to write special code. It wasn't difficult, but you still had to write special codes in order to fully utilize those. And then when they stop, well, I'm not sure if they've stopped making boards yet, but they're selling fewer and fewer. It's sort of a pain. I think the idea is that, well, if you ask NVIDIA, they're saying this isn't going away. And, well, that's probably not true. But hopefully you won't have to spend a whole lot of time porting your code every couple of years in order to be in the latest and greatest.
To comment on that question, multicores won't go away. Multicores essentially are the only way where you can increase floating point performance with constant power. And we are in the area where you are power limited, no longer floating point limited. So multicores will stay either on the GPUs or on the CPUs. And with OpenCL in particular, you have the very good promise that the OpenCL code will also run on the CPU at some later point when the 256-core CPUs are coming along. And so in that sense, OpenCL offers much better future-proof, future safety than currently CUDA does. Unless, of course, NVIDIA has also plans to extend CUDA at some point in the future.
Yeah, and like I said, they already had. I think last year they came out with the CUDA for x86.
Yeah, there's a CUDA for x86. There's also an Intel compiler now for OpenCL.
Well, right.
So.
Yeah. No, I understand. Like that, yeah. OpenCL is definitely the way to go between those choices. But.
Are there other comments or further questions? Okay. Thank you very much again, Ben.